kind of nice, having the rain. Okay, so we talked about Jesus' fragmented world, right? We talked about how important it is to listen to the Word, that really the best way to love God is to listen to Him. And so what I want to do for the rest of our time together is listen to Mark and Luke and John and some details from some of their accounts of Jesus. When we're learning to listen to the voice of whether it's Paul's letter or whoever, Peter or the Gospels or whatever, first question we ask is who is the author? Because they have unique voices and unique vocabularies and fascinating to me how some of them are interested in certain things and others are interested in different things. And with very little effort, you can come to the point where you'll hear a voice and say, well, that sounds like Mark. If it's Jesus being very emotional, that's probably Mark. If it's Jesus talking a long time to just one person, that's John. John's the only person that gives us these long stories of Jesus talking with just one other person. He's interested in that. If it's a story about someone who's amazed, that's Luke every time. Luke will say the people were amazed and excited, or he piles up these words for amazement. I call it the gospel of amazement. So we're going to look at Mark, and we're going to see some of the uniquenesses of Mark's voice. So who is Mark? We know a lot about him. We know virtually nothing about Matthew. We know a lot about Mark. He's the nephew or the cousin, we're not really sure how to translate that word, of Barnabas. I mean, come on. Barnabas. He's his nephew or his cousin. He's a disciple of Jesus. We know that's from Acts 12. When Peter gets busted out of prison by the angel, where does he go? Mark's house. How cool is that? I think the upper room, last meal, I think that happened at Mark's house. What's my academic reason for believing that? I really want it to be that way, and I think it's a cool idea. Okay, I just think it's a cool idea. When Jesus says you're going to follow this person carrying a water jar and prepare the meal, I think it's Mark, because I think that's a really cool idea. But never be dogmatic about what the Bible's not dogmatic about. So he travels with Barnabas and Paul. We know that they came to Perga, and Mark decided he wanted to go home. He'd had enough. And that eventually causes this rift between Barnabas and Paul. You know all these stories. But Mark is right in the middle of that. But the most important thing about Mark in terms of his gospel is Mark becomes a disciple of Peter. Peter refers to him as my son. Perhaps Peter led Mark to faith. You know, we just don't know, but we do know that they're very close. One of the earliest collectors of church history, Eusebius, says that the Gospel of Mark is basically Peter's testimony. The early church, they come to Mark, who is Peter's disciple, and they say, please write down for us Peter's account of the life of Jesus. So in one sense, the Gospel of Mark, really the Gospel of Peter. And to listen to Mark, again, to listen for that voice, you hear Peter a lot. I think it explains a lot of the uniquenesses. I think that's one reason why Jesus is so emotional in Mark, because Peter's probably telling the story, and Peter was on the receiving end of Jesus' emotions. He's his best friend, if he's got one, it's Peter. Peter's often on the receiving end of those emotions. So I really believe that Peter, and people way smarter than me, believe that Peter is the voice that's behind Mark. There's even a little hint in 2 Peter that they're working on this together. 2 Peter 1:15, Peter knows he's dying. He knows he's going to die. And he says, I will make every effort to see that after my departure, you'll be able to remember these things. And what does that sound like? Some of us think that's Peter referring to the fact, I've done everything possible so you'll be able to remember the things I've told you about Jesus. Meaning, I'm talking to Mark and we're writing all this down. That's 2 Peter 1:15. So that's who Mark is. The life situation of Mark, we know the life situation. Again, Luke, a gospel like Luke, we're not really sure. We think that Luke is a cover letter for a collection of Paul's letters that were submitted at his trial. That's the best guess anybody has, really. But we know about Mark. We know the life situation of Mark. Mark was written after the fire in Rome, when the first persecution broke out. We heard about that this morning. In 64 AD, Nero decides he wants to build a house. He's going to call it the Golden Palace. There's a hallway in this house that's a quarter of a mile long. And he figures, I've got to clean out the slums. And so the tradition is, and all of the most responsible historians, Suetonius and Tacitus, all support this idea, Nero set that fire. And 11 of the 14 districts of the city of Rome burned to the ground. And shortly after the fire's put out, the rumors start passing. You know, we saw Roman soldiers throwing torches into shops. And they realized pretty quickly that it was Nero that set that fire. And Nero, we're told, I think by Tacitus, he decides he has to find a scapegoat. So we're going to blame the Christians because everyone hates them anyway, right? And so we were blamed for the fire, and Roman persecution broke out for the first time. We were thrown to wild beasts. Nero at one point has a garden party in the gardens of Maecenas. He had taken over this beautiful estate by a man named Maecenas. And he has a big garden party there one night, and he lines the garden with crosses. And on those crosses, Christians are hanging, being crucified. And at night, he sets them on fire to make light for his party. That's the world that the first readers of the Gospel of Mark are living in. And Mark wants you to know, you are not going to suffer anything that Jesus hasn't already suffered. That's what you need to know about Mark. He wants his first readers to know, you're not going to suffer anything that Jesus hasn't suffered. So you listen to what's unique about Mark. And one of the best examples is the temptation of Jesus in the wilderness. Mark is not interested in that story. Two verses. He doesn't talk about the threefold temptation and Satan turned the stones into bread. Mark's not interested in that. But Mark tells you one thing. Gives me chill bumps. Look at that. Golly. Mark tells you one thing that none of the other gospel writers tells you. He says that when Jesus was in the wilderness, you know the verse, he was with the wild beasts. Now, why does only Mark say that? What's happening to his first readers? They're being thrown to wild beasts in the arena. And Mark wants them to know, you're not going to suffer anything that Jesus hasn't already suffered. Another one of the passages I love that's only in Mark, and that's when Jesus' mother and brothers decide he's out of his mind. Jesus isn't eating, and they're going to come and take him away from the presence of the crowd. I think it's in chapter 3. I love that story. And why do you think only Mark tells that story? What are his first readers hearing from their families? You must be out of your mind. A Galilean carpenter is God? You're crazy. We're going to take you away. See, lock you up somewhere. And you can go right through Mark and see these unique stories and how they're shaped address his audience. In chapter 9:49, Jesus mentions the fact that everyone would be salted with fire. That's a reference, we think, to the fire in Rome because they're being blamed for it. Jesus warns in 13 that his disciples will be betrayed by people from the inner circle, and that's happening to the first readers of the Gospel of Mark. So listen for these things when you're listening to Mark. Listen to the immediacy of his language. His favorite word is the word "uthos," immediately. I think he uses it 11 times in the first chapter. And I know NIV translates it differently every time because it sounds kind of weird if you translate it literally every time. And immediately they did this, and immediately did this, and then immediately they did that. That's his favorite word. So everything moves along. Mark is not interested so much in what Jesus says. Jesus speaks for 22 minutes in the Gospel of Mark. He speaks for almost 2 hours in Matthew, five big blocks. Okay, but he speaks far less in Mark. And what we're going to see tonight is we see the emotional life of Jesus. Jesus is far more emotional. And if you're really a pointy-headed fundamentalist like I am, you count adjectives. Mark uses 14 adjectives to describe Jesus. He's moved with compassion. He's strongly warned. He looks around in anger. He gives strict orders. He has compassion. There's a deep sigh. He rebukes Peter. He's indignant. He's deeply grieved. When you hear that kind of language, that's Mark. Little bitty Mark has 15 adjectives to describe Jesus. Luke, which is so much bigger, has six. Matthew has six. Luke has seven. John, the Gospel of John, has four adjectives to describe Jesus' emotional life. Jesus is fairly unemotional in the Gospel of John. But in Mark, there's this intensity, and we're going to see that. Only Mark gives us the literal voice of Jesus. That is, we hear Jesus speaking Aramaic. Talitha kum, ephaphtha, we're going to hear that. That's a uniqueness of Mark. And then finally, one thing that really interests me is the ministry is always sort of on the edge of being out of control. And we're going to see that from the end of chapter 1. Jesus is trying to keep a lid on things. He's hiding. He's going into the wilderness. Another favorite term of Mark is eremos topos, a wilderness place. Jesus is constantly going to the wilderness. Have a boat ready so the people don't push me into the lake, he says in Mark. So the ministry is always sort of right on the verge of being out of control. So I find that very interesting. So anyway, I want to look at two stories. And the first one is in the end of chapter 1. If I can find my notebook. Here it is. Nope, that's not it. There it is. End of chapter 1, start in verse 40. Now, a new idea for me, I've just heard this, and I can't substantiate it yet because I haven't done my homework yet, but I have read in more than one source that there were four messianic miracles. The first one was to heal someone born blind. There were healers who could heal blind people, but someone who's born blind, that's different. Obviously, raising the dead is a messianic miracle. Curing a leper. There were certain rabbis that taught that it was more difficult to cure a leper than to raise the dead, because leprosy was seen as sort of this living death. So curing leprosy was looked upon as something that only the Messiah could do. And to exorcise a deaf mute was seen as a uniquely messianic miracle. And so we're going to see Jesus healing a man with leprosy in 140. So here we go. A man with leprosy came to him and begged him on his knees, "If you are willing, you can make me clean." And here's the emotional Jesus, filled with compassion, splagnitsomai. That word in classical Greek refers to a horse snorting. You ever sit on a horse and they snort and the vibrations go all the way down their back? I translate this word, Jesus shuddered. He shuddered. NIV has filled with compassion. Other translations say that he was deeply moved or he felt pity. It's an untranslatable word. It's a difficult word to translate. So Jesus sees this man and he smells this man and he knows what his life is like and he just shudders. He is viscerally moved. And he reaches out and he does something you're not supposed to do. He touches him. Now, in Judaism, what happens? If I touch a leper, that uncleanness goes right up my arm, and I'm unclean too. Only not with Jesus, because cleanness sort of travels down his arm, and this unclean leper is cleaned. So he reaches out, he touches the man, and he says, "I am willing, be clean." And he just has to say it, right? Like God says, "Let there be light." Jesus says, "Be clean." And again, I would say this is an unmiraculous miracle. No, Benny Hinn, be healed. There's none of that. Jesus doesn't do that, with two exceptions. He just says, "Be clean." And his absolute authority, his absolute lordship, means he can say it and it happens. Okay? So, be clean. Immediately, there's Mark's favorite word. Immediately, the leprosy left him and he was cured. Now, you got to be real careful with this translation here. Jesus sent, NIV says sent, but that's another very difficult to translate word. It's simply the word ek, out, out of balo, to throw out. So I translated, he drove him away. Or he sent him away, you know, you better get out of here. I don't think he's mad at the man. I think he's mad at the situation because he knows that what he just did means he's going to be covered up with people who are just interested in being healed and they don't want to hear what he has to say. But you see the emotional Jesus. He heals him and then he goes, get out of here. Quick, get out of here. Listen, he drove him or he sent him away with a strong warning. Hear the language? With a strong warning, see that you don't tell anyone. And that's been falsely called the messianic secret. And the German scholars in the 40s and 50s came up with this idea that Jesus was somehow trying to keep his messiahship a secret. It's absolutely false. He's trying to keep the lid on. And this book I'm working on Jesus, I have several lists in the back. And I've got a list of seven occurrences of this messianic secret. They mostly happen in Mark. But here's one in Matthew 17, after the transfiguration, he tells them, don't tell anyone. Matthew 5, after he heals Jairus' daughter, he gives them strict orders that no one should know about this. He's trying to keep the lid on. Now, here's my question to you. Do they ever obey? No. How can you not tell? They always tell. So if it's a messianic secret, it's not a very good messianic secret. But usually, not every time, but usually the next verse indicates that Jesus is so covered up that he has to flee to the wilderness. It's an interesting dilemma to see him in. So see that you don't tell this to anyone, but go show yourself to the priests and offer the sacrifices that Moses commanded for your cleansing as a testimony to them. That's Leviticus 14. I was raised in a church where we were taught Jesus is the rebel. Jesus is the one who's going to kind of turn Judaism upside down. The more I look at his life, I see Jesus, he's the orthodox guy. Go, show yourself to the priests and offer the sacrifices that Moses, he's staying with the scriptures. People, he'll be in a discussion with the Pharisees and he'll say, what does Moses say? Or twice, he yells at the Pharisees, go find out what this means. I desire chesed and not sacrifice. Is it the rich young ruler who wants to know how to inherit eternal life? What does Jesus say? Obey the commands. So in some ways, Jesus is very orthodox, very Jewish, you know, in embracing the scriptures and keeping them perfectly, because you know he does that. He perfectly keeps the scriptures. When they accuse him of breaking the Sabbath, has he broken the Sabbath? No, he's violated the oral law. They're the radicals. They're the ones who are introducing these new ideas that aren't biblical. Jesus is the one who's holding up Scripture as this is the example. So go make the sacrifices that Moses commanded you to make, or go read what this means. Go read Micah. Go open yourself up to God's Word. So that's kind of a new idea for me. I like that he was a rebel, but I don't know. I kind of think it's cool that he was orthodox. I like that. And here it is. Okay, so go show yourself to Moses and offer the sacrifices, but don't tell anyone. Verse 45, instead, he went out and began to talk freely. That's what always happens. Spreading the news. As a result, Jesus could no longer enter a town openly, but stayed outside in Eremos Tapas, lonely places, the wilderness. And this is the end of chapter 1. The end of chapter 1 in Mark. He's already retreating to the wilderness to pray and to get away from this crowd that are... Yet people still came to him from everywhere. So that's a very important little window into Mark. Jesus is very emotional. There's this idea of what's called the messianic secret, and Jesus doing his thing. And there are two other passages I want to look at really quickly. I told you last night, we were talking about the unmiraculous miracle of Jesus. Well, there are two exceptions, and they're both in Mark, and I want to look at those, okay? The first one's 7:31. Now, we know how Jesus does his miracles, right? Be clean. Go home. Your daughter's well. Stretch out your hand, okay? Very unmiraculous in what he does. I'm not saying they're not great miracles. Raising someone from the dead, not too shabby. But he doesn't draw attention to himself. He always points away from himself to the Father. He always wins praise for God. And his, but by and large, his miracles are very unmiraculous. If we listen closely to his life, you see that, with these two exceptions. Now listen to this, 7:31. Then Jesus left the vicinity of Tyre and went through Sidon down to the Sea of Galilee into the region of the Decapolis. And if you track it, he's sort of avoiding the Jewish area, the heavily, you know, Jewish population. So he's going down to the Decapolis. There some people brought a man to him who was deaf and could hardly talk. That is a word that only appears one time. It's a here's your big word for the day. That's a hapax legomena. Why use a little word that everyone can understand when you can use a big word that no one understands, right? That just means it's a word that only appears once. And the word is mogilalan. Mogilalan. It appears once in the Septuagint in Isaiah 35. Be strong, do not fear, your God will come. He will come to save you. Then will the eyes of the blind be open and the ears of those who can hardly talk will be unstopped. No, and the tongue of those of the dumb, that's it. That's the tongue of the dumb will be unstopped. And that will shout for joy. That's Isaiah 53. I think it says 4. I can't read my writing. But that's a very interesting word. He could hardly talk. He was deaf and could hardly talk. And they begged him to place his hand on the man. After he took him aside, away from the crowd, see, there it is again. He's not doing this to gain attention for himself. Okay, let's go over here where nobody can see. So he takes him away from the presence of the crowd. But now listen to this. Jesus put his fingers into the man's ears. Then he spit and touched the man's tongue. He looked up to heaven and with a deep sigh said to him, Ephphatha. Now, does Jesus have to do any of that to heal this guy? Something else is going on. He's doing something. It's prophetic activity. He's making a point, okay? He's making a point. Let's see if any of my notes say it any better. So with a deep sigh, there's the emotional Jesus. He says, be opened. And notice there's Jesus speaking his native tongue. At this, the man's ears were open, his tongue was loosened, and he began to speak plainly. Jesus commanded him not to tell anyone. There it is again. But the more he did so, the more they kept talking about it, and people were overwhelmed with amazement. He's done everything well, they said. He even makes the dumb hear, the deaf hear, and the dumb talk. So that is, if you've been listening closely to the way Jesus does things, you're going to go, I don't get that. I don't get that. That was unusual. Something's going on, okay? So that's the first example. Here's the second one, 8:22. They came to Bethsaida, and some people brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. It's interesting, they know he can heal people, but when Lazarus dies, everyone says, well, if you'd have been here, he wouldn't have died. No one thinks he can raise him from the dead. Nobody can do that, right? But he can heal people. They have zero expectations that he can raise Lazarus from the dead. So they bring in this blind man, and they beg Jesus to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and led him outside the village. You see a pattern forming? These are details. We got to listen to the details of Scripture and ask ourselves, what is he doing? Well, he's not using miracles to make his popularity go up. He's doing them, you know, away from the presence of the crowd. Jesus knows he's not his gift. He's come to give himself. He hasn't come to give his gift. Now he's gracious and loving, and he has the power to heal, and he will heal people even if it works against him, because that's the sort of person he is. But he always points away from himself, always wins praise for God. That's his heart. That's how he does his thing. So he took the blind man by the hand and led him outside the village. When he spit on the man's eyes and put his hands on him, Then Jesus asks, do you see anything? Does that bother you? This is a guy who can raise people from the dead. Did he not use enough spit? Did he, you know, we have this sort of magical idea of healing. This is not magic. This is his absolute lordship, right? He doesn't have to do any of this stuff to heal. He could have stayed right where he was and just said, you know, go home, you'll be healed, whatever. So Jesus is up to something. And if we're listening closely to the text, we go, this isn't right. This is not how he does stuff. So he says to the guy, do you see anything? He looked up and he said, I see people. They look like trees walking around. I love that. I love it because I can do that. I know exactly what that meant. People look like trees walking around. So once again, it's a partial healing. And I think this is the only one. He partially heals someone. But he's making a point. And it's so cool. And in a minute, it's all going to be clear. Okay. So I see men looking like trees. Once more, Jesus put his hands on the man's eyes. Then his eyes were opened, his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. Jesus sent him home saying, don't go into the village. The implication is, don't tell anybody. Okay? Okay, so there's this, in the midst of all these very unmiraculous miracles, all of a sudden he's shouting and spitting and partially healing people and doing these things. He is up to something. And the key passage happens right in between these two stories in chapter 8. I'll start 14. The disciples had forgotten to bring bread except for one loaf they had with them in the boat. It's a whole other issue. We won't get into that. Be careful, Jesus warned them. Watch out for the NIV translates it yeast, but it's still the word bread. Watch out for the bread or the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod. They discussed with one another and said, is it because we have no bread? Of course, they're clueless. They're wrong, right? Listen closely. Aware of their discussion, Jesus asked them, why are you talking about having no bread? Listen, do you still not see or understand? Like the blind man whose sight was gradually restored? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see and ears but can barely hear? And don't you remember when I broke the 5 loaves and for the 5,000, how many basketfuls? And we're going to look at that later when we look at Matthew. But the point is, Jesus, the point he's making when he does those two unusual healings are parables of the gradual opening of the eyes and the ears of the disciples. He's making a point. And I think he's hinting at what that point is about right in the middle. And he's doing that for us, isn't he? Our eyes are gradually opening. Sometimes in my spiritual walk, I just see people like trees walking around. I really don't see. But we have this example of Jesus healing that our sight will be completely restored someday. We will completely hear someday, like the blind man and the deaf man. So those are two unique parables, and that's one example of just listening to the detail of Scripture and seeing what's going on. Let me benedict you.
I knew I'd mess it up. All right, one more time, see if I can remember it. Don't think. There it is.
Remember to love one another and do what is pleasing to him. Be strengthened by grace and worship in reverence and awe the God of peace. This is your part. grace be with you all. And may the great shepherd of the sheep equip you with good things for doing his will. And grace be with you all.
Come on, try it.
Grace be with you all. May the great shepherd of the sheep equip you. Equip you with good things for doing his will. And grace be with you all. Forget not the suffering of Jesus, and bear the disgrace that he bore, confessing his name, for Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Grace be with you all, and grace be with you all. May the great shepherd of the sheep equip you with good things for doing his will. And grace be with you all. And grace be with you all.
Now go in the name of the one who loves you so much, he would rather die than live without you. Go in the name of the one who will gradually open your eyes and your ears so that you can see and hear and understand just how much he loves you. Go and be his people and love each other well. Go.